Okay. I'm hoping that I can remember to touch on a couple of things that both speakers have said so far, because there are themes that are running through this that we really should think about sitting down together and addressing, I think. Wonderful things. The first thing that Gary, of course, mentioned is place-based long-term studies. And that was the whole reason that I set up this study. And I have to ask myself the same question over and over every year. Why the hell did I do it here? Because the Himalayas is not the easiest place in the world to work. It would be a lot nicer if I could do it in my own backyard. But there is a reason to go to the Himalayas, aside from the fact that it is drop-dead beautiful and has wonderful cultural people in the region. But the Himalayas are very important. First of all, nothing to point here. Point. How do I do this?
Second button.
No, the top button. Oh, yeah. Anyway, the red bits on this map are the high biodiversity areas in the world, and unexpectedly, there's red bits throughout the Himalayas. So as far as the temperate areas of the world go, it's the highest biodiversity hotspot in the world. Secondly, when you look at climate change, this one is temperature. There's this purple region here in the Himalayas. And outside of the poles, which are purple, it's got some of the fastest increase in temperatures. And then as far as rainfall goes, projected precipitation, again, it's got this purple area and stippled purple area, and it's got the largest increases in rainfall predicted, 20 to 30% increase. And this is an area that already has monsoons, so tremendous amounts of rainfall. It's, you know, considered the third pole because there's so much ice and snow in that region, and climate change is expected to change. You know, you've heard melting glaciers. I don't have to, you know, go back to 101, right? So it's an extreme, and that will impact the whole area, impacts climate around the globe, impacts circulation patterns and climate, so that as it's melting, not only will it affect water supply for over a billion people only in the world, but also it will affect climate around the world. So there's lots of reasons that, in fact, getting my ass up those mountains is, in fact, important. Over the last 10 years, I have set up a 1,500-kilometer transect across the Himalayas, from including Nepal and Bhutan and parts of Tibet and China. This is a long-term study where this whole area culturally is... this is a map from National Geographic, and this whole area is culturally on the edge of the Tibetan cultural extent. And although Bhutan certainly and Nepal is a little more tolerant, but does not want to be considered Tibetan culturally, you know, there is a linkage for the area. And I, unlike many people in this society, I'm botany first, and so the botanical end of things is spectacular, and that's nothing to sneeze at. Many, many of these plants are useful. On the average, we get over 50% of the plants are useful, and that's an underestimate. That is, you know, what we are told about or can identify. Most of them between 4 and 5,000 meters high, because that's where we can monitor the effects of climate change the most rapidly. And Tibetans go up to that area at a Tibetan doctor at least once a year will go up for about a month to collect medicinal plants. It's known for medicinal plants. Tibetan people graze their yak and other animals up in that area. And it's also important for sacred areas. These high mountains, the number of sacred mountains throughout that region, most of our sites have associated sacred mountains. So that these are the main, but there are many, many other useful plants as well. We joined a global network. We didn't want to reinvent the wheel. We wanted to have comparative data around the world. So a couple of years before I started, a group in Europe started monitoring climate change long before anybody in this country ever is willing to face up to the fact. And so they joined a group called GLORIA, Global Observational Research Initiative in Alpine Environments. And being good kind of Germanic folk, they have very detailed methodologies. And so we followed this. You know, it's got its problems, and it's, you know, it is Germanic. But culturally sensitive remarks. But it's useful to have comparative data. And here, these are just pictures of us doing the research. But what we do that the group in Europe and elsewhere now in the world, we have it also in South America and so on, is that we try to work with local people, and we do ethnobotany besides the glory of climate change monitoring. Here we are doing this Germanic thing of, you know, 10 centimeter by 10 centimeter quadrats, counting all the plants within them. Whee, that takes time. Lots of data, lots and lots of data. This is just here. I'm not going to have time to go through all this, but just to tell you that there is a lot of data. So the basic vegetational trends that we find are we see precipitation and elevation, which is elevation is kind of we can think of temperature when we think of elevation. Determines vegetation types, and these are changing. Vegetation is biogeographically distinct across that transect. We can definitely see the differences, biogeographic differences in plants across that area. Extremely high beta diversity from site to site to site to site. There's a lot of diversity, as well as alpha diversity, you know, within a site. There's very high endemism compared to Europe even, but because it's so high, endemism tends to be found at high elevations. And this is the area that is so vulnerable to climate change. I already mentioned the medicinal plants, so I guess I can skip that at the moment. So last year, we started finally, 7 years in Tibet, we can go back after 7 years and resample, so this is the long-term data set. And we find the Europeans, so they're a couple years ahead of us, so they've already published their data, and except ours, they did it all in 1 year. They had this huge network, and everybody did it in 1 year, so they finished their study, whereas we have to do it year by year by year because we haven't done it simultaneously. But we do, where these little stars are, oh, shoot. Now what do I do? Now I do this. Sorry, wrong button. Where these stars are is where we are pretty sure that we are getting the same or greater. So we get an increase in biodiversity. Plants are moving, as Wilt said, plants are moving up the mountains. We're getting an increase in biodiversity. And by the way, the paleobotanists will confirm that usually in periods of warming, we will see probably in most areas an increase in biodiversity. Now, what that biodiversity is and what it's useful for and so on is the big question. The alpine flora is moving up the hill. We can see that. And we think, we're pretty sure that our effects in the Himalayas are probably more rapid than Europe, because we can see the differences site by site, whereas in Europe they had to analyze the data over all the sites to in order to find significant differences. Okay, so this is an ethnobotany group, so I'll mention some of the research on ethnobotany. Perceptions, you know, we first went out, as most of us have done, and looked at, you know, do people see climate change? And yes, in fact, they do. And as many indigenous groups around the world will have voiced, the fact that they see climate change in terms of a spiritual, in spiritual terms. So a lot of them will talk about, well, we're, you know, in China, they'll say, well, we're worried that during the Cultural Revolution we didn't pray enough. And so our gods, these sacred peaks and the gods on them are leaving us. This woman says, I'm worried that the earth will be destroyed if the snows disappear. They see the snows, you know, disappearing off the mountains. So they definitely perceive it, but they perceive it in very different, in a moral and religious sense, rather than, you know, scientific sense. They are definitely adapting to climate change, and this is the example that I usually give, but given what Gary has just said, I want to mention a study that we've just done, and thanks to Katie Conchar. Katie, are you here? Thanks. Okay. Wherever. I heard the voice. Please talk to Katie Conchar about this. I'd like to talk about the adaptation in a site that we worked in last year in Nepal, because it's so interesting. It's right at the transition. It was about 3,500 meters, and the transition between tree agriculture and the traditional grain, you know, barley agriculture. And yes, people were adapting. People were planting trees. Orchards were moving in. Vegetables were moving in. But the people themselves were eating their traditional foods. They were selling the fruits and vegetables to the tourists or to the markets. And so we need to think about not only adaptation in terms of crops and so on, but in terms of culture and in terms of, and the processes by which people change is, I think we have been underestimating that. I think we have the assumption that culture can change easily. I don't think that's true. I don't know. Anyway, something to talk about. mitigation. This is something, because most indigenous people don't have a good concept of, you know, CO2 in the atmosphere and greenhouse warming. Some of them do. Some of them have, you know, seen Al Gore, you know, the pirated versions of Al Gore's videos, you know, and get it. But in general, they don't think about mitigating it. Nonetheless, they have so many practices that mitigate climate change, and that, you know, we have, mitigation is in the hands of red, you know, and it's in the hands of the tropics. And there are so many other ways of mitigation that we have just narrowed our version in our vision in a time when we need to be expanding our vision to find as many and as diverse a group of mitigation factors as we can. And just because a tropical tree might fix more carbon than, you know, a sacred grove in Tibet, doesn't mean that we still shouldn't fix that carbon. You know, we're not in a competition here. We have to work together. Anyway, Himalayan people incorporate a lot of organic matter into their soils so that they can farm on very, very steep hillsides. They do it in order to incorporate organic matter as quickly as they can. But it's also fixing carbon. There's more forest as the forest moves up the hills and they're using their traditional forest management. There's actually more forest than there used to be in areas that are traditionally managed and, you know, don't have outside logging. These people, in general, live a carbon-negative livelihood. So we need to learn how to do that. And then they have the traditional methods of conservation, these sacred sites and so on, that we need to learn from. And we are trying to promote the conservation of across the Himalayas of an archipelago of these sacred sky islands, and which is a problem. In some countries, it's easier to talk to people about it than others. China's a little bit of resistant to this whole idea, and we're trying to get countries that have not collaborated very well working on the same thing. So we'll see. But these are some of the sacred mountains that are in our area. This is why I call my ass up the mountain. We've done a lot of studies on sacred landscapes and how much more biodiverse they are, and how the trees are bigger, and so on and so forth. So I won't go into all that. I'm running out of time. So anyway, we've also looked. You can't just kind of step in and go, oh, I'm taking over your sacred areas for conservation purposes, because for Tibetans, they're obviously not conservation areas. They have their own cosmology, both of climate change and their own cosmology of sacredness and areas. And we have, if we're going to collaborate on things like this, we have to understand. I'm preaching to the choir. I don't have to tell you this. This is an infomercial, and on the front desk here, there is a copy of this book. And there's an order form that if you buy it at this meeting, you get a 20% discount. And if anybody here is willing to review it for the journal, you get a free copy. Just write to the editor that's on that piece of paper. Thank you very much.